You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hey y'all, this is Mark. Welcome to episode 57. The last show was all about Mardi Gras and Carnival. We talked with Ted Flott from the Historic Mobile Preservation Society about who invented Mardi Gras, Mobile or New Orleans. We learned about many of the similarities the two cities share in their history and in our celebrations of Carnival and Mardi Gras. We also talked about the differences between what you'd see in Mobile compared to New Orleans, and Ted even shared some insider tips for things to look for in the French Quarter that might tip you off to the tie-ins into Mobile Mardi Gras. It was a fun discussion, and it was one where I learned a lot, especially about Mobile's Carnival celebrations and their traditions. If you missed it, go back and give it a listen. I think you'll really enjoy it. Today's show is a replay of one of our most popular episodes. It's a discussion I had with Sally Asher back in September 2016 about the cemeteries in New Orleans. I get asked about the cemeteries all the time, and I thought this would be a good one to pull from the archives. If you follow us on Facebook, and you can probably hear it in my voice, then you know I've been battling the flu since I got back from vacation a little more than a week ago. I've been knocked out, and I just didn't have the energy to put together a full new episode, y'all. Each one takes between 12 and 20 hours, and I just was wiped out. So I'm recording this on Mardi Gras evening, which is February 13th, 2018, and I only started to feel better yesterday. We're working on some great future episodes about local music, the Myrtles Plantation up in St. Francisville, and a whole lot more. And so I thought this would be a good opportunity to jump back to one of the most popular shows and share it with you, particularly when we hit this time of year where lots of people are going to be coming in to visit for Jazz Fest and French Quarter Fest and just weekend getaways. Before we do jump in, though, I want to run a quick word about our sponsor, Lionheart Prints. You might remember Liz Marty Cook, the chief enthusiast over at Lionheart, from the episode number 51 that we did. That was the show where we featured three New Orleans business owners, including Liz, Kristen over at Home Malone in Carrollton, and Patty at Chop Industries. If you headed to New Orleans for French Quarter Fest or Jazz Fest, like I mentioned, or just any time, be sure to stop in and check out Lionheart. It's on Magazine Street, just off Louisiana Avenue, and it's clustered among a great group of stores. Over at Lionheart, you'll find beautiful hand-lettered cards and prints, one-of-a-kind offerings by local artists, some really cool t-shirts, and a whole lot more. I love my Who's Your Crawdaddy t-shirt. You might have seen it if you follow us on Facebook. And I wore my Everywhere Else It's Just Tuesday t-shirt today on the parade route. Head on over to Lionheart Prints and say hi to Liz and the gang over there next time you're in town. Use code BEYONDBOURBON, that's one word, at checkout to order things online or in store, and you can save $5 off any t-shirt. Again, I really love them over there, and I love the t-shirts and the products they sell, so check it out. With that, let's jump into the discussion today with Sally Asher. And there's a couple of things, again, I mentioned we recorded this in the fall of 2016. Sally's Instagram account has changed. It's now Sally_Asher, A-S-H-E-R. But I think the conversation holds up. It's a great discussion about the cemeteries and how we bury people, as well as the stories of the people that are that inhabit the cemeteries in New Orleans. With that, let's jump in. Today's guest is a writer, a photographer, and a historian. She's a graduate of Loyola and Tulane Universities here in New Orleans, and is a frequent lecturer on a wide variety of topics relating to New Orleans history. She's published three books, including Stories from the St. Louis Cemeteries of New Orleans. She's none other than Sally Asher. Welcome to the show, Sally.
Thanks, Mark.
So, how did you become a New Orleanian?
It's a kind of very odd story. I went to an all-girls Catholic boarding school in Colorado, and my roommate was from New Orleans. And I had never met anybody before who was so passionate about their hometown. You and I had talked about that, how you field questions from people who heard you were from New Orleans.
Sure.
She didn't necessarily field questions. She just kind of inserted, you know, history on me. So I came down to visit her. She was born and raised in the French Quarter, which, of course, at the time, I thought everyone was born and raised in the French Quarter. I thought that's what New Orleans was.
Right, right.
She actually was raised in the Spanish Stables on Governor Nichols Street. And so when I graduated, I thought, well, I'm young, I'm not married, I don't have children. I'll just come and live in New Orleans for a few years, and then 20 years later and a few degrees later.
A little bit warmer.
Yeah. And it was not an immediate reaction like some people have. It was kind of like a gradual, you know, one of those gradual, slow-burning love stories that you hear about when you turn to a friend and realize that there's, you know, they're much more. It was like that for me.
I have a theory about New Orleans that the humidity seeps into your pores. And once it gets in, right, it pulls in all the other good stuff with it.
Or your brain. I had come at a time, usually in the spring and fall, and I had never experienced humidity before. And it was a shocker about the first 12 years that I lived here. It's taken a while.
So I also mentioned in the intro that you're a photographer. So when did you first become interested in photography?
Gosh, a child. And it mainly was just to document. I was always the one with the camera. I would save up my allowance to get film, to take pictures of the nieces and the nephews and the family and the cats and the dogs and the sheep and the cows. I grew up on a small farm. And it's just another way of telling stories.
And you have some of those photos of animals and other things on your website.
Yes.
At sallyasherarts.com.
Yes.
And it's SallyAsherArts. I also saw that you can check out Sally on Instagram at smasher727.
I have not been as good with that. I need to post more. I do show some restraint because I could post 10 pictures of my dogs every day. But I usually put a lot of outtakes or cemeteries or New Orleans scenes. I love shooting at sunrise. I think New Orleans is kind of more known as a sunset city. But sunrise, when you go into the French Quarter at 5 o'clock in the morning, there's just this whole different feel to it. It's this very eerie quiet, but then you get the kind of stragglers or service industry people. Right. And then once it hits 7 o'clock, it's everything kind of turns on. Everybody comes in to bring the beer and clean the streets. But there's this nice little window between 5 and 6:30. And I like to take my camera and roam around a lot during that time.
Yeah, well, the pictures I have seen on your Instagram account are great. But you're right, that's sort of a magical moment in the quarter. Both pieces, like you said, the people who have been out all night, the service people. And there is, I don't know if it's just the way the sunlight comes through the French Quarter at that time of morning or even right before it comes through.
And they clean the streets,
right.
And, Jackson Square area during that time. So you have a nice little reflection of water off the lights and they're slowly turning on and the Mississippi River. It's beautiful time. It makes you exhausted for the rest of the day, but it's a nice time.
It is too. If you then, so before we moved home years ago, we would stay downtown a lot and wander through the quarter early in the morning, and it's great. And then you're right. If you go sit down and have beignets at Café du Monde, an hour later, the whole thing's changed, and it just seems to amp up, right, all through the day.
One of my biggest regrets was a couple years ago on All Saints Day, I came down at 5 in the morning to shoot some pictures, and I got the photos that I wanted. It just happened to be All Saints Day. And I got back in my car, put my camera away, and was driving away. And about 6:30, saw four Wonder Womans, because, you know, it's the day after Halloween, straggling down the street really early in the morning. And I just like, oh, why is I need to keep my camera in the front seat just to lean over and get that picture. Every photographer has that, though, the picture they regret.
Just another day in New Orleans,
yes.
Too, I guess. That's a great insider tip, by the way. If you have an interest in photography and you're in New Orleans, try to get up at least one morning early and wander through the French Quarter, like you're saying, 6 o'clock, 6:30 in the morning. You can really capture the architecture without so much of the crowd. It smells a little better, you know,
particularly
freshly washed, cleaned up. Right. But that's a great peaceful time to be in a place that you typically think of as not so peaceful.
And you can witness, as you said, it's pretty rapid.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's pretty amazing within 30 minutes what happens. And you have the crazy tourist joggers jogging through the French Quarter that everybody in the service industry, and they're, you know, they're loading the beer in and they're washing the streets and cleaning up the garbage, always seem to have these very odd expressions for the jogging tourists through the French Quarter.
Well, true confession, I have been one of those runners through the French Quarter on some of those mornings. But you're right, you get those looks and you bump into the guy unloading the beer truck and the guy cleaning out the alleys and all that. So, hey, the reason I asked you to join me today is that I wanted to talk about the cemeteries And you mentioned All Saints Day, so we'll certainly get into that. And as we were talking before we came on, I get asked questions all the time about New Orleans, but the thing that comes up the most often is the cemeteries and questions about, well, how do we bury our dead and how do we celebrate and what's the idea of are they really buried in ovens and what is the year and a day? And so I was trying to figure out what was the best way to approach that. And I did what I often do on the podcast or when I'm thinking about a topic, and I went over to Octavia Books.
Great bookstore.
They're a great resource. And they were the ones, the good people over there were the ones that said, hey, you ought to read Sally's book and you ought to reach out to her. So they led me to you.
Oh, well, thank you, Octavia Books.
Let's jump in a little bit. I'd like to start with, if you could kind of walk us through, you know, what's the history of why do we bury our dead here the way that we do? And we'll kind of walk through some of the traditions.
Well, to kind of first touch on what you were talking about, how people ask you so much about cemeteries, that's how I came to write the book. I had given a lecture at the U.S. Mint, and somebody had seen it, and they contacted me and said, do you want to be a guest lecturer on the Royal Caribbean Cruise Line? And I remember thinking, that's a thing? I had never heard of that before. But they had, when they were stationed here, they would have a local historian go out on every single cruise and give lectures. So you're supposed to do 3 lectures and you get a free cruise. And apparently all local historians knew about this except for me. So I went and I realized when I was talking, it was my first time lecturing to a non-New Orleans audience. Lagniappe, Second Lines, where you at? And they were all interested in the topics, but they all wanted to know about the cemeteries. I got so many questions on cemeteries. And so when I started, I never imagined writing a book on cemeteries, and I started to kind of research and realize that while there are books out there that kind of give general overviews or just beautiful photography, I wanted a book that talks about the people. Like, who are these people that are buried in there? Why are they important? Why were they infamous? What kind of footprint, you know, did they leave? And I wanted to do something more than say plantation owner or sure. mayor or this, you know, really tell their story. So it was from outsiders, from going on a cruise with people from all over the country and asking me, you know, that's what they were interested in. And I live by St. Louis number 3 and would see the tour buses pull up and they do a spiel for like 5 minutes and then they say, go walk around and take pictures. And I'm constantly accosting people in the cemetery and saying, do you know who this is? Do you know whose tomb you're standing in front of? You know, because I think people tend to go for either the really grand tombs or the much more kind of modest crumbling without any type of thought on, you know, these are real people. It's easy to get very dazed and, sure. you know, and kind of in awe of our cemeteries.
Right.
Because they are beautiful and they are unique. So basically, the first cemetery that we had was below ground. And it was located in the French Quarter, and it was St. Peter's Street Cemetery. And there was, of course, time problems when it would rain extra hard and grandma and grandpa would, you know, pop up and kind of float down the street after, you know. And there was also times that a lot of times they would just dump people into the river. And there was a law at the time that anybody who was convicted of a crime was not allowed to have a proper burial. So there's articles that I found of convicts being hung and begging, please, please give me a proper burial. But they said it was kind of a wink and a nod. They would toss them out into the bayou or into the river and look the other way. And a few hours later, medical students would come and take the bodies and do experiments on them. So the city pretty much knew about it. They just looked the other way. It was kind of an easy way. We're going to throw the bodies here in this swamp and river. A few hours later, medical students trot out, pick the bodies up, and start dissecting them. So basically, it was the Great Fire that occurred in the 1700s that they realized they need more space. So the King of Spain shut down the burial in the French Quarter and did St. Louis number 1, which I thought was really interesting because we were underneath Spain's rule at the time, but they named the cemetery, you know, after the French, you know, after the Sun King. No, not the Sun King. After the Saint Louis. And it kind of grew from there up until like the early 1830s, and we needed more space. And at the time, they felt that most diseases were caused by poisonous vapors, either from decomposing animals, grapes, vegetables that went rotten, that these was what caused yellow fever. So that's when they built St. Louis number 2, and they wanted to have it 2,400 square feet away from the city, which at the time was just the French Quarter, and they had to compromise to do 1,800 feet away. So most people, which I find really interesting, tourists that I talk to, I will be in front of St. Louis number 1 or near there, and they say, well, where is St. Louis number 2? Like, it's just, it's 5 minutes away. It's a diamond in the rough. St. Louis number 2 is, I think, vastly overlooked, and kind of this bastard stepchild of St. Louis number 1 does not get the appreciation it deserves.
Well, and it's surrounded, right? I mean, you have the RV park we were just talking about, and the Claiborne Overpass, which at one time, Claiborne was a beautiful street.
Oh, it was gorgeous. It was absolutely gorgeous.
And maybe that's a topic for another podcast episode, actually, but that was a beautiful oak tree-lined street, and so I can imagine when St. Louis number 2 was put there, it was in a fairly prominent place for being outside the city, outside the French Quarter. And it wasn't until the 60s and early 70s when essentially Claiborne Avenue, as it was known, was destroyed with the overpass.
If you can look up photos during that time, just these beautiful, beautiful oak trees lined up and down the street. Absolutely gorgeous. And what was interesting when I was doing my research for number 2 was we came very close to having a completely different plan for number 2. And there was this dentist named Plow he was kind of a jack of all trades. And basically, before we had a design that was voted on, he drew up this design of what St. Louis number 2 was going to be. And he advertised in the newspaper for all citizens, great and poor, because it affected everybody, to come down and to view his designs. And eventually, even James Gallier Sr., as well as other architects, published a card in the newspaper, local newspaper, saying, we viewed his design, and we think it's sound, and we think it's a good design. And what it called for, which would have been, I can only imagine if this is the way we went, was a long rectangle with a huge cypress grove, and then a giant pyramid on each side of the grove. And the pyramid would have stairs that would lead up to the top of it, where you could walk up the side of the stairs and sit on top of the pyramid and look out of the groves and the statue of the Greek poet Homer that was to be in the middle of it. And they had designed it where you would have 3,000, you could fit 3,000 bodies into each pyramid. And you would basically move from one period to the next to fill it up at this time period. And it passed 2 different city council votes, so it came very close to being built that way, until at the end they deemed that it was too expensive, and they went a much more modest and traditional route for New Orleans.
Could you imagine? That would be a very different scene.
That'd be a completely different landscape.
And you tell that story, among many others, and we'll get into them, in your book. And once again, I want to mention that it's called Stories from the St. Louis Cemeteries of New Orleans. You have several books, but that one specifically talks about the history of the St. Louis cemeteries. And what I love, and you alluded to it earlier, just like this story about the dentist, is you really make the cemeteries come alive. You talk about the histories of the people that live there, some infamous, some famous. We'll get into some of them. And I think you're right when you talk about the tourists coming, say, to St. Louis number 3. There's so many individual stories there, and some are big and some aren't. But you could really take yourself on a tour of New Orleans by just spending time in the cemetery and looking up the names and kind of digging in. And your book certainly makes that easy and accessible for people.
Oh, thank you. That was my intention. Thank you.
Well, you definitely succeeded. And even for me, having grown up in the city, as I was reading through, I didn't know who was buried where. But again, you have big stories and small stories, Maybe we should jump into a little bit of with All Saints Day coming up, and talk a little bit, if you would, about that tradition and where that comes from and what we do here in New Orleans.
Well, this dates back to the early 1800s, and what I found that it was basically, I would say, bigger or equal to Christmas and Mardi Gras. It was a huge, huge event. they would have, people would start selling, you know, the flowers and the fashions. Like that was kind of like your fall fashion debut. Then you would come out to the cemeteries. And it's basically a way of what they called it as anniversary of the dead, a way to honor and remember the dead. So you would have, they would sell special drinks for the men, like this Creole kind of ginger beer. Vendors would set out outside the different cemeteries and sell candy and cakes and drinks and toys. And people would come in all dressed up. Most of the men would tend to leave early and go hit the bars. It was a very, very big drinking day. And it was this spectacle in the sense that, as what I said, it would be, you know, kind of somewhat of a fashion parade where people would picnic, clean the tombs. They would set out, sing songs, picnic out there. You would have that on one side, and then you would have a, you know, heartbroken, grieving widow across the aisle who's just completely destroyed and broken up. It was also a big fundraiser time for orphanages. They would kind of trot out the orphans and dress them up and put them out. The nuns would put them out in front of society tombs. Different society tombs would allow different organizations to collect money. So you would go into the cemetery and you'd have picnics and flowers and candles and people sobbing and women dressed to the nines and then packs of orphans, you know, standing in front of the tombs soliciting money from you to take donations. And one of the things that I found, unfortunately, after the book was published, I found this back in the 1800s, that it is, the Creoles would, one of the common phrases when they would take the children in, you know, the big family, not to kill the lizards. There was a saying, they would believed that if you killed a lizard in a cemetery, that you would be dead within a year. And if you kill a lizard in a cemetery on All Saints Day, it just goes much quicker. So they'd say they'd be hustling their children in and be like, don't kill the lizards. And just interesting. And what I also found about it, even finding articles back in the 1830s where New Orleans was writing to visitors coming in, encouraging them to come out and take part in their tradition and to watch this unique tradition. And it was almost kind of, you know, we talk a lot about New Orleans being a tourism city and about advertising when this started, but it was very open arms and very welcoming, you know, Protestants, Jews, come out and join in our cemetery and our tradition and have fun. It was really interesting.
I wonder when that really died down.
They used to have, you know, there's periods of mourning in the French Catholic, and the first year and a day is always the most severe. You know, all black. You can only basically no social engagements. Only see really close friends and relatives. It was basically like a 2-year period. You go through second mourning into third mourning. You could wear a white collar. You might be able to wear something purple. You're not allowed to wear anything shiny, because they believed when someone close to you died, it made you, your grief made you much more susceptible to the devil, and shiny materials attracted the devil. So you couldn't wear anything, any jewelry or anything really bright. The mourning period kind of stopped around World War I. They felt that it was not good for the soldiers' morale for widows to be dressed all in black. It really kind of seemed to be probably around the 1960s, 1970s, where it's kind of become, it still happens today. You can go out there. I went out to St. Rock a few years ago. I try and go out every year, and I try and hit a new cemetery, or at least two different ones that I did the year before. And there are people with the picnic table set up and Popeye's chicken and beer and just drinking in front of grandma and grandpa and, you know, letting them know what was going on. And so while it still happens, and it's a much less, more scaled down event, it's not as plan in advance, plan your outfit, you know, people coming out hawking their wares. So it's scaled down, but it still exists today.
Interesting. And so, and you kind of mentioned it, you know, part of the idea of how we bury our dead is because the water table here in New Orleans, you know, for the most part, we're 6 feet below sea level. In some places, a little bit higher, a little bit lower, but it doesn't work out so well to bury the deceased in the ground. So here we have tombs and we have crypts. We have, as you mentioned, and we can get into a little bit, the society tombs. So can we kind of walk through a little what the different types of things you might find, the different styles of burial plots or crypts that we might find if you wandered into one of the St. Louis cemeteries?
Gosh, there's such a wide variety. Wall vaults seem to evoke some of the most curiosity. Latrobe, Benjamin Latrobe, who described them as like honeycomb. They look like these giant honeycombs. And if you look at photos from, gosh, even 80, 90 years ago, you can see them sinking into the ground. They're finally getting their burial below ground. That's a much more cheaper and efficient way. They take the plaque off. They pull out, the coffin and the remains. Some of them have a vault that they drop down underneath. Otherwise, they're just kind of pushed to the back. You're hopefully like your relatives because you're going to be with them for a very, very long time. And why some societies or cities kind of might think that as being grotesque, as being overcrowded, it doesn't seem to be that way in New Orleans. And for example, the most popular tomb in St. Louis, number one, is obviously Marie Laveau. And she is kind of, I believe, the reason why the Archdiocese just said, enough, and why they put such strict restrictions on St. Louis number one, where now if you're a Louisiana resident, you can go in, you show your driver's license, you can go in on All Saints Day. Other than that, you need to have either a research pass to go in, which you have to get in advance, or you need to have a relative who's buried there and let them know in advance that you want to see them, or you have to go in with a licensed tour guide who has to sign in and check and document how many people they have coming in. And this is because of just the incredible vandalism that was going on during the time, particularly in Marie Laveau's tomb, people marking X's with nail polish and lipstick and marker, tour guides trying to, pull bones out and breaking off bricks of other tombs just to try and impress and, wow the tourist. And it just became too much. So, but going back to it, Carolyn Morrow Long, who wrote a biography on Marie Laveau, recently researched her tomb and found over 80 people buried in Marie Laveau's tomb. And then she went and broke them down by race and gender and age and where they were. And a majority of them were blacks and there were whites, and a lot happened to be neighbors. And many were white neighbors who died and didn't have a place to, bury their loved ones. And Marie Laveau said, "You can use my tomb." So she's buried with a lot of her, neighbors or cousins who might be, twice removed, who could not afford a place to be buried. And to be properly buried and respectfully buried was extremely, extremely important during that time period. And so her bones and dust are mixed in there with a whole bunch of other people, which is absolutely amazing.
That's one of the themes that surprised me as I read your book, how often exactly what you described, somebody that had, say, a family vault or a family tomb would open it up and offer it to, whether it's a neighbor, or you see it throughout your book with some of the big chiefs of the Mardi Gras Indians, or now some of the musicians.
Ernie Cato is like my favorite.
So that would be a good segue. We'll have you talk about that in just a moment. But that idea, right, of it almost becomes a community or a neighborhood once again. Why don't you tell us a little bit about, some of the listeners may not know who Ernie Cato is, and certainly the story about how he came to be buried and where he's buried.
I'm always amazed when people don't know who Ernie Cato is. And he is probably the one, I will have to say this, for word count wise, Ernie Cato's entry is the longest. And so I feel like that will make him very, very happy, since he is the emperor of the universe. But Ernie Cato was a R&B singer, and he was the first, he had the first number one song that came from a studio in New Orleans. And it was kind of what we would call a one-hit wonder, which was Mother-in-Law, which Alan Toussaint wrote and Ernie Cato recorded. So he had this kind of amazing rise. And he always said, the three greatest singers in the world are Ernie Cato, James Brown, and Ernie Cato. And then in about the 80s, so this happened in the 60s and the 80s, he kind of fell on hard times. was an alcoholic, had a drinking problem. He was a DJ at a while for WWOZ. Ben Sanimel, who wrote this amazing book on Ernie Cato, sent me some of the tapes so I could listen to them because I had heard people describe them, but I wanted to listen to them myself just to hear. And a lot of times he just kind of ranted about how great he was and his own music. And basically he met Antoinette, and she was a costume designer. She got him cleaned up, got him his own place, the Mother-in-Law Lounge, which is located in the Treme. And he would start performing there, and he kind of had this kind of second coming, you could say. Started performing at Jazz Fest. He had this old CD, CB radio, where he would sing along. The jukebox was programmed to play Mother-in-Law all the time. So he passed away. He died, and they had some family plots for him, but they were outside the city. And Antoinette was very stressed and said that he wanted to be near the bar. He wanted to be in his hometown. And Anna Ross Twitchell, who was a friend of theirs, and she became a friend of theirs when she had to escort them to this TV production convention to meet Jerry Springer. And Ernie Cato was so excited to meet, you know, Jerry Springer. And they became friends since that. So her daughter had just inherited their family tomb. And so her daughter agreed to let Ernie Cato be buried in her family tomb, thus desegregating this tomb that had been in their family for about 150 years. So they opened the tomb up and they let Ernie Cato be buried in there. And eventually Earl King and Antoinette herself are all buried. And so Anna Ross Twitchell's daughter, Heather, is a classically trained musician. And she's like, yep, hope it's not too soon. But, you know, I'm looking forward to one day being, you know, mixed in with all these great musicians and characters.
Well, and in your book, I didn't actually do the page count. But if Ernie Cato is first, his wife Antoinette is pretty close.
It's pretty close.
And she's quite a character. And so today, yet another New Orleans musician who's a character has taken over the Mother-in-Law Lounge, and that's Kermit Ruffins.
Yes.
So you can still go there, and again, Kermit in his own way is every bit a character, and I think would agree with that assessment. So you can still go to the Mother-in-Law Lounge today there on Claiborne, and right, it's very close to the cemetery there, too.
She said he wanted to be buried next to the, you know, near the bar. But that's one when I see a tourist coming in, I almost always, it's a very hard tomb to find. It's very confusing. And I will usually just grab people and tell them about Ernie Cato and then walk them through the cemetery to show them where he's buried.
And in your book, you have a great story about after he passed, Antoinette would dress up a mannequin,
yes,
with his clothes and sort of carry the mannequin around, almost like Weekend at Bernie's style.
Yes, right? He'd make appearances. And she'd unscrew his hands once a week and take him across the street so he can get a manicure because he liked to look fine all the time. And she said he would dress him socks, underwear, head to toe. And a lot of times their outfits, as alive as in dead, their outfits matched. She made both their outfits. So Ernie Cato, the human, and Ernie Cato, the mannequin, they would typically be dressed to match. And they made the cover of the Offbeat, I think it was Offbeat magazine, dining at Galatoire's together. And it's one of those things where you're just, you know, only in New Orleans. And they just sum that up so well.
When you talk about that, it sort of reminds me of another thing that is unique to New Orleans, and that's the funeral procession and the way we do it in the second line. You know, and Ernie Cato had a big second line celebration. And so for people that aren't familiar, let's talk just a little bit about how that works and how that came about.
Well, I'm sure as we could also get deep into discussion, there's a lot of controversy on it now about are we selling our traditions? Because anybody can have a quote-unquote second line right now. And there was a recent article, I can't remember where it was from, if you can recall, if you've read it, just within a few weeks ago, stating how many permits they get per year. And I think it was something, I might be misquoting, like 400.
It's staggering, yeah.
How many permits that, you know, corporations are putting on for
a conference, and our conference ends on Tuesday.
Potato chips and weddings and birthdays and divorce second lines. And they've kind of, I don't want to say What's a non-offensive way to put this? I don't want to say bastardized, but that's kind of what it is. And you know, you'll have tourists who will come in and say, "Oh, what time does the parade start? What time does the second line start?" Like, this is what we do. But the tradition that goes on with the second line is that you see many times in the French Quarter is not a true and real second line. Danny Barker, who was this just amazing musician, very much wanted to bring it back to the traditional second line, which does have military roots. Bruce Rayburn and Matt Sacchini have written extensively about the history of second lines. And they're still just like the word Creole, where exactly Creole comes from or Creole means. It's somewhat as that with second lines. Some people say that it was white military. Other people say that it was African Americans. But basically, you would have the second line, meaning you have the group of mourners in the family, and the second line, the back, is kind of the lesser. It would be, you know, mother and children and parents, and then maybe close friends and cousins. And you have this funeral procession. You're leading them to their next life, basically, with music and song. And so as you go there, and the men, traditionally men musicians in the white shirt and the black hats and the suit, play very solemn march dirges to there. And once they get to the funeral, it's kind of the release and the celebration. And now there's a lot of controversy about, you can just hire a brass band and get some handkerchiefs and march down the street and dance and be in some second line, but it's not real.
There've been several articles and on the Tripod podcast, they've covered that a little mm-hmm. bit recently, which is another great local podcast that's leading up to the tricentennial of New Orleans, and they talk, I think it's over a couple of episodes actually, about that New Orleans in the 60s and particularly in the 70s, as we sort of chased after tourism a bit, you know, with the rise and fall of the oil business. So, you know, when we started having second lines in the Mardi Gras Indian traditions, outside of the normal rhythm of the calendar and the events of life, things like Jazz Fest, it's really great because people do get to see it. But then, you know, then where does the line, it starts to blur and blur, and where does it stop? So now, you know, someone says, well, I'd love to see the Mardi Gras Indians, but our convention is from Monday to Thursday. Can we make that work? And someone says, well, you know, it's a way to make money, so they do it. And then it just sort of spirals down a little bit like the second line. So you're right. If you are here and you happen to come across a true second line, the mourning and then the celebration of someone's life, it's a pretty, pretty amazing spectacle to see, I think. But it's not the same. What you see on any given Friday or Saturday night in the French Quarter after a wedding, while it's fun, it's not the second line that is New Orleans per se.
I wish we could come up with a different name for that, so we could keep our other one. Like Louis Armstrong actually loved being in second lines. He loved playing in second lines in funerals, and you know that was paying gigs that were actually real. Mm-hmm. As compared to gigs where you're just trying to make a potato chip company or whatever company show your tourist a good time. And, you know, we're so dependent on that economy. But it's a blurred line between tradition and culture, between people being able to make, you know, a living
right
in comparison to honoring their roots and culture. So it's difficult.
Yeah, and I imagine cultures go through that. Here in New Orleans, where we hold our traditions and culture so sacred, I think it's an interesting issue that's coming up more and more lately about that. And I sort of see both sides of it. You don't want to lose the tradition and the actual meaning of it. You don't want to make it like Las Vegas.
But then you want to feed your musicians
right.
as well and your performers.
You know, and one of the things you talk about in your book when it comes to You outline, and I certainly want to touch on some of them, you outline some of the famous musicians, and you mentioned Danny Barker and Ernie Cado, and the fact that a lot of times musicians, when they die, they don't have a lot of money. They don't have a place to be buried. And in fact, one of the stories in your book is about a vault, or I think it might have been a benevolent organization, mm-hmm. that they converted over so that it's a musician's tomb.
Yeah, that was, there is, I think, and this might be off the top of my head, roughly 70 to 80% of the tombs in the cemetery are empty and vacant. People have vanished. They can't track them down. And so they actually wanted to turn one of the society tombs and number two to the musician's tomb, but it just became all these complications. So they had the society tomb, and they tracked down the last known owner, happened to be one of the Barbarans. And so they agreed to dedicate a certain amount of vaults to local musicians. There's various Mardi Gras Indians, you know, who are buried in there, as well as musicians. And that gives them a, you know, a place of dignity and respect. And that's why society tombs basically were started. These benevolent societies were mainly started by immigrants who could not afford, you know, elaborate tombstones, but they still wanted to be buried with some sort of dignity. So they'd pay, they would have a collector, you should go out once a week, maybe every 2 weeks, and collect their 5 cents or their 10 cents. And this would guarantee them, you know, a proper burial in the tomb when they passed, which was very important to them. And so it's nice that we have a place for musicians that they can go and be honored.
Yeah, and you know, to me, that's a tradition that, unlike what we were just talking about in some of the tourist things that have become of, say, a Second Lime, that's a tradition that's sort of come full circle back. And you think back to these benevolent organizations. And even things like the Zulu Social Aid and Pleasure Club started in much the same way, one as a parade and to sort of mock Mardi Gras, but also to take care of the neighborhood and to take care of people who might have been disenfranchised or had no other means because of the time period of being able to have proper things, whether that's burial or it's medical care or insurance or whatever it might be. So when I hear the stories about sort of repurposing the tombs for people, for musicians who have given so much to the city and so much culture, but at the end of the day deserve a proper burial and might not have it otherwise.
I had experienced something like that myself. You know, I had spent all this time researching and writing, you know, about the importance of this and how these are actually human beings in here. And about 2 or 3 weeks before my book came out, I had a friend pass away, and another friend offered his family tomb to allow him in St. Louis number one to be buried in. And never did I, you know, St. Louis number one has so much history. Never did I ever think that I would be attending a funeral in St. Louis number one of a good friend. And, but it was one of their friends. He had almost exact same situation. Ernie Cato had inherited a family tomb, which was right by Bernard Marini, and offered it up to his friend so he could be buried. And it was very, very surreal to be on the other side of it, just right after I had finished the book, to be in there and be attending a funeral and the really, really strong emotions, and then out of the corner of your eye seeing, you know, tour groups go by. And my friend, it was her stepson who was 19, who had, you know, she was very upset that tours were allowed in here and groups were allowed in here, and this needs to be a, you know, a sacred place. And so you sometimes just get lost in the mystery and the myth and the beauty, and not realize this is still, to me at least, you know, sacred ground, and it needs to be respected.
You see the same thing. I lived for many years in Northern Virginia. We actually live right next door to Arlington Cemetery.
Oh, wow.
And you would see the very same thing that you would see, particularly for most of my adult life. We've been in a period of war, and you would every day see people being buried with honors, you know, military veterans. And at the same time, you would see the tour groups and the tour buses. And I think it's a fine balance. I think it's really important for people to go and see and wonder and teach the kids about, well, why is this here and why is it so massive? And tell the stories there like you do here in your book. And at the same time, there has to be some sort of sanctity and respect for the burials that are going on. And in a place like Arlington, those burials are happening multiple times every day. So there's no way to sort of cordon it off. And I think the same thing happens in the St. Louis cemeteries here.
Just Very few, though. I mean, there's only a handful a year that happens in St. Louis, number one.
Sure.
And so, yeah, never did I imagine that so closely I would be actually attending a funeral of a loved one in the cemetery. But his family is based in Seattle now, and so All Saints Day, now I make my stop to visit him.
And that's a really sort of neat way to continue on the tradition, bigger than any individual family or any person, of New Orleans. About, I do think we have this history of taking care of people and taking care of the dead and welcoming people in. And obviously that's at sort of the most needed time at the end of life. And that's one of the things I was really surprised about as I went through your book. And you mentioned Bernard Marigny and his impact. And maybe you could talk about that in a moment. But how often those tombs are opened up to people outside of the names that are on the tombs.
Bernard Marigny is probably one of my favorite New Orleans characters. He's literally right up there. And I've been researching his tomb. I've researched Marigny. Any kind of history that happens in New Orleans, he's bound to come up. He's touched through so many different areas of the city and is just an amazing character. So I had come back, and I can't remember if it was on All Saints Day, but it had only been about 6 months from the last time I had been there, and this was when St. Louis number one was still open. And I've been focusing mainly on, I've been doing my work on 2 and 3 at the time, and I saw a plaque up there on the side of Bernard Marigny's tomb. And it said, you know, Lloyd Sensat. And I remember thinking, who is this? And so I started to do some digging, and also saw the name Gene Sizek, who did not have an end date to him, and discovered that Bernard Marigny's, I hope I get this right, four or five greats, grandson or nephew, Lloyd Sensat, was this amazing educator and illustrator, and just loved New Orleans and loved Bernard Marigny, and really brought, he and his partner Gene brought a lot of awareness to Bernard Marigny, to the Treme, and did so much work, and became friends with Marigny's relative, and they allowed him to be buried in the tomb, and Gene will be buried in the tomb as well. So right now his name is up there. It's already engraved in. The plaque is up. And I went to Gene's house, and he was gracious enough to let me in and let me see some of Lloyd's work and to talk about him and interview him. And so after the book came out, I had no idea that there was an annual Lloyd Sensat Award given for research. And I won the Lloyd Sensat Award for my research. So I get really emotional. I don't probably do really awful at any kind of formal award ceremony, but it was very touching.
Sure.
It was one of the highlights of the book, was to be able to meet Gene and see the work that Lloyd had done and the impact that he had, and know that there is this just amazing person and educator out there. He won Teacher of the Year through Disney, through the entire country, and just seemed to really have this zest for life. And I love the fact that he's in there with Bernard Marigny, and that Gene will be in there one day, and that his relative William Bill allowed him to do so, and just wonderful. So I always stop by, and I feel like he's a friend now almost, and say hello to him when I'm there.
It's such a great story, and you go into it in some detail in the book, but I knew about them. I did not know the tie-in to Marigny until reading your book. And Marigny, right, was quite a character. And again, I'll leave some of that for the book. But again, we keep coming back to this idea of these sort of unusual tie-ins and these sort of partnerships, if you will. And the book, again, is sort of full of just one story after another about people. One of the others, though, buried there in St. Louis number one that you talked about, was Paul Morphy. And if we could just maybe say a couple words about Paul. I think most people have no idea who that name is.
He was a rock star, basically. He was a chess master rock star, if you can believe that chess masters were rock stars at the time. And he was, he was a genius, basically. He started playing chess at a young age and started beating all these different masters. He was very little. He was, I think, maybe a little bit over 5 foot, had this really large forehead and was very thin. And he, at the time, he had was studying to take the bar. He had memorized the entire Louisiana code in French and in English, but he was not of age yet. I think he had to be 21 at that time in order to get your license. So he got an offer to basically travel to Europe, where he was a huge sensation and people came from all out. And he played chess in this Paris cafe, which, if you can imagine, and then I believe it was like eight games at once. And he had his back turned. So he sat with his back turned and simultaneously played eight games at once. And he would just say, would call out the move, and then they would say what the next one, and could remember it. And I think he won 7 and tied one. And that's just,
wow.
Chess historians, which I am not, and I am not a chess geek by any means, still marvel over this feat and go over his plays. And then he just quit. He just abruptly quit. He didn't like the attention. He was a very nervous and shy man, and kind of just became somewhat of an eccentric, and basically slipped, they said, in a cold bath and died. And his old family house is actually Brennan's restaurant. But he, up until I found articles in the 1920s and 1940s, the house was still a main attraction. People still coming to see where Paul Morphy was buried and where Paul Morphy, you know, lived. And now nobody knows about him. But really, up until World War II, probably early 1950s, he was still a huge tourist attraction in New Orleans.
And then sort of on the opposite scale is James Gallier Sr. And James Gallier, if you've listened to the podcast a bit, you know we did an episode about the history of the Irish in New Orleans and talked about some of the things that James Gallier Sr. and Jr. worked on, including Gallier Hall. But I didn't realize until very recently the way that, and maybe you can talk about where James Gallier is buried, but the way in which he died. And we just hit the anniversary of that, actually.
Yes, 150 years. That was something. So in most of the articles or research I would do, I'd read James Gallier died in a shipwreck, the Evening Star. And I was basically just trying to find more information, just to write a couple sentences about it, just to give some more nuance. My background is in literature and fiction. So I will obsess over trying to find of what someone looks like, or what, so I can add a description or something that's a lot more memorable than just listing facts. So I found that the sinking of the Evening Star, it was a luxury steamship that ran from New York to Havana to New Orleans. It was a weekly line, and it was kind of the steamship to happen. Well, it went down in a hurricane in 1866, right after the end of the Civil War, and it was already notorious because it was at this time that it was common practice for New Orleans madams, very prominent, extremely, extremely wealthy madams, that they would travel to the East Coast and they would go through the local brothels, spend maybe like a few weeks or a month up in New York and Baltimore and Chicago, and handpick the best prostitutes to come back to season in New Orleans, which our season was tended to be, you know, kind of around Thanksgiving, Christmas, up until spring. So it was this huge scandal that the newspapers wrote about it before it even left, that there was all these madams and about 100 prostitutes traveling on the Evening Star, as well as a French opera company and a French circus company. And one of the newspaper articles said, well, you know how moral, how loose the morals are of stage people. So it was already this huge scandal. And it was the only time that in its few years of existence, which I want to say was like 3 or 4 years, that it was actually written about when it departed from New York Harbor, because it was so scandalous. And then a hurricane went down and it took out every class of society in New Orleans, from the prostitute up to somebody like James Gallier. There were some generals in the war. There were some high society people. And there was argument that God sank the ship, because it was loaded down with iniquity. And they said that not one place of entertainment had been affected by it, from the brothels to the theaters to the opera house. And they did different fundraisers. There was stuff, a lot of a morning in Saint Roch in Paris. And then you find out there's scab labor, and the company was cutting corners, and it was this huge cover-up. It just became this amazing story. And I wrote about it for Louisiana Culture Vistas, and I'm working on it for an adventure, a book, because it puts the Titanic to shame. I mean, you think about the Titanic, and it's awful, but you get into your lifeboat and you go down, and that's right. It. This was like going down in this violent washing machine. And also, even though this had been after the common, women and children first, the crew, most of them who had never been on some of them were just working for their passage and were taking oars and beating people off, would not allow them into the boats, and trying to hit them and smash their heads in. So you're in a hurricane, you're going down, and the crew is commandeering the lifeboats, which you can't even launch, and it's in this huge... And so a lot of people died, just decapitation, and then you've got... Some of them were 4 to 5 days out in the open sea drifting, and sharks and people going insane and throwing them. So, I mean, it's...
So you have a terrific, a fascinating and gruesome accounting.
Sticking on the Halloween theme.
You mentioned it. I will link to it. And again, you can find Sally's work at sallyasherarts.com. You can also find her books on amazon.com. But I will put a link to that. I was actually reading it this morning for a couple reasons. One, the anniversary was September 29th.
Well, that was when it launched. So it was October 3rd or 4th.
So right about where we are now. Mm-hmm. And the similarity, it made it down as far as south of North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And so at this very moment in time when you and I are recording, you have this Hurricane Matthew coming up sort of the opposite, right? Up the Atlantic coast, up Florida, and into that same general area. So it's just an odd sort of timing thing. But again, the article's fascinating. You're right. That could certainly be a book in its own, I would think.
Oh, man. Yes.
And so all that stemmed from James Gallier, who was this very famous, prominent architect in New Orleans with a very large reputation well beyond New Orleans, ends up on this ship coming back with prostitutes, among others, right? Ends up dying, of course, and ends up in a St. Louis cemetery here.
His son built a huge... tomb for him in memoriam, and then died shortly after. And if you go around the back, you can see his little, just a few years after Gallier died. And I've not been able to discover if the tomb had been finished at that time. I've been trying to go through the archives, because a lot of these tombs, the Borelli tomb, which is in St. Louis number 2, which is an amazing story, took something like 6 or 7 years to build. And Gallier Jr. died just a few years after his dad. So I'm still trying to discover if anybody knows and would like to tell me if it was finished before his son's death or not. But he's just got a tiny little, poor guy, he designed it, and now he just has this tiny little plaque around the back to...
Right, he was a prominent architect in his own right.
Yes, very much so.
And that's one of the things we were talking before we started recording, that you can pull on almost any thread in New Orleans and go so far down the rabbit hole and find these amazing stories and these tie-ins to other things. And here we are talking about the cemeteries, and we could spend easily an episode and probably write a book about Gallier, not only the way he died, but the way he lived and the impact.
When I was doing, example of that, when I was doing research on the Court of Two Sisters and discovered that through the assessor's records, that they actually owned the house at 810 Rural Street that collapsed. They were the ones that sold it to the family that had been in the family for generations, but that was some of the sisters' home that they had lived in from the Court of Two Sisters fame before it just recently collapsed, just 2 years ago.
Right. Wow. Are there one or two more that you would want to highlight? I have a list. I could go on and on.
But... Oh, you can tell me. Andre Caillou. And number 2 is probably one of my favorites, and probably one of my most frustrating. He's just this amazing hero, amazing man, and I believe that everyone in New Orleans should know who he is. He does not get the proper recognition. He was a former slave who his owner would allow him to hire out. He was in the cigar trade, and he was able to purchase his freedom. And then I believe purchased his wife's freedom. And he was in the, during the Civil War, he joined the kind of the Louisiana Native Guard, which was basically for show. And then when the Union took over New Orleans when Butler came in. He joined the Union Army, and he was one of the, his regiment was one of the few regiments to actually see battle, but one of the few black officers to die in the Civil War. And what happened is it was basically a suicide mission. They had to go take Port Hudson, and the Confederates had the advantage being almost 300 feet up. And he just kept pressing forward, saying, you know, onward, my children, onward. And he was shot and killed. And it was tradition during that time that after the battle, they would allow a ceasefire for people to come on, both parties to come on to the fields and take their wounded or their dead off. But since they were black soldiers, the Confederates refused. And so Caillou's body lay out in the open for, almost 2 months at that point, and was only recognizable by his benevolent society ring that he joined. And so they had a huge state funeral for him. And even the New York Times and Harper's Weekly wrote about it and saying there was not a head uncovered, and they had never seen a, and they had a military marching band music for it. Blacks, whites, free people of color, slaves come out to honor this man. And then the priest who did the ceremony for him had been basically kicked out, excommunicated because of his abolitionist views. And then after the Civil War, all these Caillou societies were formed to fight for blacks' rights for Reconstruction. And they actually brought his flag into the United Negro Convention that they had in D.C. and hung the flag up, his bloodstained flag, to, you know, inspire and motivate people to, you know, blacks to fight for their rights. And just amazing, amazing man. And he was a boxer and apparently cut a very dashing figure. And he took pride on being, he called himself the blackest man in New Orleans. And so he's someone who I definitely feel needs more of our respect and honor. But he was one of my favorite finds.
One of the other ones that also in St. Louis number two was Henriette DeLisle.
Yes. She's getting, I don't feel too bad for her because she's making her way. She's starting to get famous. You know, she's not an unknown, but she formed the Sisters of the Holy Order. She was an African-American nun. The Ursulines wouldn't let her in. It was basically against the law to have interracial religious groups. And so she formed her own order, and she's two steps away from being declared a saint right now. And we renamed a street after her a few years ago.
That's right.
So hopefully she'll drive some more traffic in to number two, and if she ever makes sainthood. But yeah, you have Oscar Dunn in there, who's the first lieutenant, black lieutenant governor, and you have Jordan Noble, the Dharma boy. Dookie Chase is in there. Claude Treme is in there. There's a lot of great duelists and fighters in there. John Davis, who formed the pretty much brought opera to New Orleans, is in there. And Nicholas Girard, you know, from the Napoleon House, who's this character, Dominic Yeo, who fought with Jean Lafitte, who was this pirate, and he died penniless, but he fought in the war. And, you know, we tend to love people like that. So they gave him a state funeral, and they paid for him. And James Ferret, architect. It just goes on. And just some absolutely amazing people in there.
Which is why you should pick up Sally's book, because you do go on. There are dozens of stories there. One more, if we could, that intrigued me because I had done an episode and mentioned her earlier, and I hope I get her name right, Margaret Horry?
I think it's right, Horry.
Horry?
I believe that's how you pronounce it.
I think
Yes. She's
a really interesting character. Again, we did an episode about the history of the Irish in New Orleans. So she's this immigrant, comes to New Orleans, her child and her husband die very soon.
Like a year. Right. She's illiterate.
So now here she is, she's an immigrant.
She was an orphan herself. She was like 23, I think, somewhere around that. Yeah.
So then she spends her life basically helping the nuns and taking care of orphans, right?
She, in some ways, she has the great American story where she volunteered a lot for the orphans and worked in the convents and stuff, and gets a dairy cow or two, and then gets more and sells the milk and donates the rest and gets this huge dairy farm and then invests in this first steam bakery and ends up becoming this incredibly wealthy, prominent woman who can't even sign her own name. And they just knew her as Margaret. She's like Madonna or Cher or something. And when she died, you know, and they ran column after column after column, and it said, you know, just Margaret, and they had a state funeral, and they had mayors and politicians and everybody come out, and she had donated her most of her fortune to the orphans, and they called her the Bread Lady. And they said that she was the one woman that Butler was afraid of. She's just old. She's not as she's a little dour and tough looking. And they'd say she was very always dressed modestly, kind of calico in her bonnets, and she'd be pushing her wagon across. And the Union troops would be like, "You can't cross here." And she's like, "Yeah, I can." And they just kind of stand back and let her pass and go through to deliver her bread to people in need. And she was very much beloved. And I think I just found it. So she has one of the first statues dedicated to a woman in the entire country. And if you go into St. Louis, number 3, her grave is unfortunately unmarked. But the Little Sister's tomb, which is kind of in the front, if you look at the very, very top, it just says donated by Margaret. That's engraved into the tombstone. And I think that was something I was shooting and just happened to look closely and notice. So that's a little tip to go in and check that out.
That's a great insider tip. And she there's a tiny little park and a statue of Margaret down at Britannia.
Yes.
Right at the back of the warehouse district. There's like a one block that's renamed Margaret Place. And you can see that kind of dour expression that you're speaking of. I think they've captured that well.
She was very beloved, but when the statue was unveiled, they said that they put a beautiful child next to her, basically to offset her appearance. So that could be why there's this beautiful kind of cherub-looking child next to her too.
I also think one of the many things that's interesting about her is, you're right, sort of in many ways this American success story. And yet there was this, as I was doing my research on her, there's this real conundrum too, in that she was an immigrant, she helped orphans, she did all these things, and yet she was a slave owner.
Yes. That was fairly a recent discovery, and I have actually had many conversations with local New Orleanians, and this topic's come up, and I said, "Oh, you know, Margaret owned slaves." No, she didn't. "Well, I'm sorry, she did. That's a fact. She did." No, she didn't. And in one case, she had owned a mother, and I believe it was a son, a young son. And she either sold the son to Baton Rouge, or she sold the mother to Baton Rouge, or vice versa, and essentially orphaned them. And so this was done, and I can't remember the name of a recent thesis that I had discovered that I read. I can't tell you how many times I've bumped into people and I'll hear their name and I say, "Oh, I've read your thesis." They get really excited because nobody reads people's thesis. And she had this historian had traced it and tracked it and found receipts. And so it's hard when you have somebody like that and you say, "Well, you know, she didn't own a lot, but she did, in fact, was a slave owner."
Yeah. And I just think
people sometimes have a hard time reconciling that.
Well, and we're at a moment in New Orleans now where there's a big debate about some of the statues in the city and their celebration of slave owners, right? People like Robert E. Lee and Andrew Jackson. And I think as I was researching Margaret and then reading your book, it brings up this very complicated history, you know, and in her case, someone who did just a tremendous amount of good, but it's not all good. And there's this other side of it. And of course, the irony that you point out that she dedicated her life to helping orphans, and she, in effect, created an orphan.
Yes.
And then there's this sort of, and then she's buried in a plot in the cemetery there, along with the nuns, right? Mm-hmm. So lots of complications, and maybe that's just indicative of New Orleans. And
I mean, we have, you know, we love Jean Lafitte. We love him. He was a horrible, horrible person. You know, not only was a slave owner and a slave trader and a slave stealer and a murderer and a rapist, and, you know, we have national parks named after him because he's this, you know, for better or for worse, New Orleans loves its characters. And you can kind of get away with a lot on either side if you have some kind of flair and, you know, panache to you, basically.
Yeah.
Like I said, for better or for worse.
And that's probably a good wrap on that. I did want to mention, you've talked about we've talked predominantly about the three St. Louis cemeteries here in the city, and there's numerous others in the city. Probably the best way to experience, well, one, I would certainly say again, to read your book, but probably to go with a tour guide, with the possible exception, I think, of St. Louis number 3, where you really can wander around, and if you spend some time, and then maybe do some research on your own, again, with the book or online. Is that what you think is the best way for people to get to experience and maybe know a little bit about?
I guess it depends on how you operate. I love going exploring by myself. I still go on tours around New Orleans all the time, and I love doing it. But it just depends. Greenwood and Cypress Grove are two other cemeteries that I feel are kind of underrated. Lake Lawn Metairie Cemetery is breathtaking. I mean, it's absolutely breathtaking. It's this beautiful, like most of our cemeteries, outdoor museums. Holt is extremely personal and very moving, as is St. Rock as well. I would say Save Our Cemetery is a great organization, and they do a lot of tours throughout the city through different cemeteries. Do your research, and it depends on how much you want to take away from it. I always think it's a little sad. Some people just really want to go and get beautiful, nice pictures of interesting graves and really aren't that concerned about, you know, who's in there or what they did. But if you are, read my book, read other people's books, take a tour, just spend some time walking around. St. Louis number 3, has Jean Galatoire and has Belloc, the famous Storyville photographer, and has James Gallier, and just people tend to get very enchanted by the front of the cemetery's gorgeous angels. It's predominantly angels, and they don't really wander that far back, but always wander back.
Well, and I
always
hope
take the side road.
Yeah, that's a great point. I hope that's what you take away if you're listening to the show today, that it's more than just the architecture and the details and the ornamentation, but that those graves represent real people with amazing stories, whether they're well known and they were famous or not. Again, I've said it several times, but if you get the opportunity, you should come do that. Whether you come to New Orleans or not, pick up Sally's book. Again, it's Stories from the St. Louis Cemeteries of New Orleans. It's terrific. We've covered some of the people, but there are dozens that you talk about in great detail. And if nothing else, I think even as a New Orleanian, it opens your eyes as you wander around. Again, we've talked about a couple that aren't easy to find, whether they're prominent or not. You mentioned James Gallier Jr., sort of a little plaque on the back of his father's very large tomb or crypt. I'll put links in the show notes to not only to your books, but Save Our Cemeteries you just mentioned, and some of the other cemeteries and the resources available so that people can learn more. You can find the notes for today's show on our website, which will be at beyondbourbonst.com/22. And again, I'll put all the links to how people can contact you and get your materials. But you can find Sally at sallyasherarts.com. You're on Instagram and Facebook, as well as Twitter, and I'll put the link to the books. We talked primarily about the one book, because I might see if we can get you back to talk about some of your other books another time. And you're also working on a book we were talking about Prohibition. So that's downstream a little bit.
I'm really excited about that. Yeah, that's going to be published by LSU Press next year. So I'm just finishing up now and working on some other projects as well, but it's a topic, surprisingly, that hasn't really been written about or examined.
And I'm very excited about that. Again, we were talking about it before we started recording, and New Orleans for having such a history when it comes to alcohol and drink, and there's surprisingly little that's easily available to read about the stories of that time in American history and in New Orleans particularly. Well, thanks so much for listening, y'all. And of course, a special thanks to you, Sally.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a pleasure getting to know you and getting to hear about it and the resource that you provide to people who are interested. If you want to hear more shows like this one, please subscribe on iTunes, on Stitcher, or Google Play Music. And if you have an idea for a future episode or you just want to reach out to me, you can get me at mark@beyondbourbonst.com. We love doing the show and hope you love it too. If you do, please tell others about Beyond Bourbon Street. Until next time, laissez le bâton rouler.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.